99.5 FM in New York, and this is Iggy Pop.
WBAI New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. It's 7 o'clock on a Friday morning, and coming up next is What's Going On with Johanna Fernandez.
There's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see.
All right, folks. Good morning. It's 7:02 and 55 degrees in Central Park. We'll see a high near 73 degrees, and it will be sunny this Friday, May 26, 2023. You're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial, Free Speech Radio, WBAI, at 99.5 FM in New York. I'm Johanna Fernandez, your Friday host of What's Going On. Good morning, Michael, and rest in power, Tina Turner. Last week, we talked to Betty Metzger about March 8, 1971, the night that eight anti-war organizers broke into the FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania. That was also the night of an epic fight between Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier. The anti-war activists hoped that the frenzy around that highly anticipated fight would provide cover for their actions. They broke into the FBI in hopes of finding proof that the FBI was snooping around their organizations and trying to undermine their movement. This morning, we continue our conversation with Betty Metzger, and she'll tell us how exactly it was that the world discovered the existence of COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program of the FBI. Betty Metzger joins us again this morning. She's the Washington Post journalist to whom the anti-war activists sent the files they found in that Media, Pennsylvania office of the FBI. But first, stay tuned for the Pacifica Network News.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
Veterans have given enough. They don't need to be hit again, especially by a manufactured crisis.
Vietnam veteran and Democratic Representative Mike Thompson of California says lawmakers should work through the holiday weekend to ensure the nation does not enter a historic default. Thompson says millions of veterans would be impacted by delays in pension payments, disability compensation, and health care. Experts predict the U.S. has roughly 1 week for House Republicans and the White House to reach a deal on the debt ceiling. The Supreme Court has dealt a major blow to the Clean Water Act, narrowing federal authority over wetlands. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre says the decision takes the country backwards.
The Clean Water Act is the reason why America's lakes today are swimmable, why we can fish in our streams and rivers, and why safe drinking water comes out of our taps.
The court said wetlands can only be regulated under the Clean Water Act if they have a continuous surface connection to larger regulated bodies of water. The ruling limits the Biden administration's efforts to restore protections to millions of acres of wetlands. Texas is on track to join other GOP-led states that have pulled out of a bipartisan effort to ensure accurate voting lists. The Electronic Registration Information Center, or ERIC, has become a target of suspicion among Republican activists. Texas State Representative Valerie Swanson questioned ERIC's mailings to remind eligible voters to register.
You're sending cards to people who may appear to be eligible, but perhaps they're not a citizen, or you don't realize they're a felon in some other state that's not part of ERIC.
Texas lawmakers plan to replace ERIC with their own unproven system. Florida, Missouri, West Virginia, and Louisiana have also recently left ERIC. South Carolina joined its neighboring southern states Thursday in banning most abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy. South Carolina Governor Henry McMaster says he is confident the law will withstand any legal challenges.
Ultimately, I think you'll have a lot of states addressing their laws and making them much more stringent than they are today.
Providers quickly filed a lawsuit seeking to block the law, saying it comes just 4 months after the state's highest court halted a nearly identical measure. The founder of the Oath Keepers extremist group has been sentenced to 18 years in prison for his plotting to attack the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. Stuart Rhodes is the first person charged in the attack to be sentenced for seditious conspiracy. His sentence is the longest that has been handed down so far in the hundreds of Capitol riot cases. And Connecticut lawmakers are considering the most wide-ranging package of gun safety measures since the 2012 Sandy Hook school shooting. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
And thank you, Catherine. It's 7:07, and you're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial, free speech radio, WBAI, at 99.5 FM in New York. I'm Johanna Fernandez, your Friday host of What's Going On. WBAI is hosting its spring fund drive, and it started Monday, May 22nd, this past Monday, and it'll go through Sunday, June 4th. And as you well know, we are your listener-sponsored non-commercial radio, meaning we need your help keeping the lights on to bring you the conversations you want to hear, the issues that affect you, and the people you care about. During this fund drive, we'll be celebrating the hosts and programs of WBAI Radio, past, present, and future, the history of the station as an institution of our city, the nation, and the world. Our premium offers are series collections of archive material, which we'll offer for a pledge. And we here at What's Going On Friday are putting together our very own special gifts for you, for our listening audience. And we're going to do that next week. So tune in next Friday, June 2nd, to find out what we're going to come up with. And most importantly, to continue supporting your station, WBAI. We want to remind folks of the value of WBAI Radio as a platform for the open exchange of ideas, support WBAI and help keep this non-commercial, listener-sponsored radio station alive. We want to keep it alive, well, abundant, and relevant. If you appreciate what you hear on the station and you want us to keep bringing you this kind of programming, become a buddy of What's Going On Friday. The number to call to support this station and this show in particular is 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Or you can go to give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org. We also offer access to previous shows in our archive at wbai.org, where past programs, hour-long teach-ins, if you will, are available to consume at your own pace. You can download, share with family, friends, students, or even bring to your church. Go to wbai.org, click on menu, and look for archives or previously aired, and find the shows you're looking for by name or date. So that's, once again, you go to wbai.org, you click on menu, you look for archives / previously aired, and you find your show by name or date. Your contributions allow us to continue to offer this resource to our communities for free. What do you think? Are you ready to become a buddy of our show? What's a buddy, you ask? Well, becoming a buddy means that you'll support our show for as little as $5 a month on a regular basis. If you'd like to do that, please go to WBAI, givewbai.org. That's give2wbai.org. Give2wbai.org. Or you can just call us at 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. And make sure you say that you're with Johanna and Marcos and What's Going On Fridays, and that you can't get enough of us. You like us. You like to wake up to us in the morning. So why don't you join us as buddies of the show? Say yes to keeping WBAI alive by calling 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950, or go to www.give2wbai.org. It's 7:12 a.m. and 55 degrees in Central Park. You're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial, free speech radio, WBAI, at 99.5 FM in New York. And I'm Johanna Fernandez, your Friday host of What's Going On.
Income eligibility limits for the Medicare Savings Program have increased. If you make $2,260 a month or less, you may qualify for a Medicare Savings Program to help pay for your premium, deductibles, coinsurance, and copayments. Connect with a Get Covered NYC specialist to see if you qualify for a Medicare Savings Program. Call 311 and ask for Get Covered NYC or visit nyc.gov/getcoverednyc. Connect with a Get Covered NYC specialist to see if you qualify for a Medicare Savings Program. Call 311 and ask for Get Covered NYC or visit nyc.gov/getcoverednyc.
será. Pobre nos duro poder soportar. Será fácil si me han de ayudar.
And that was La Ayuda de la Amistad, with a little help from my friends, by Jesús Enríquez and Miles Peña, from the album Tropical Tribute to the Beatles. On March 8, 1971, the night of Muhammad Ali's first fight with Joe Frazier, eight activists involved in the movement against the Vietnam War broke into an FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania. The anti-war activists were looking for proof that the FBI was snooping around their organizations and trying to undermine their movement. They found hundreds of documents detailing FBI surveillance and disruption of Americans. The activists sent the files they found to Betty Metzger, a journalist at the Washington Post. They also sent the files to two journalists at other newspapers, and two members of Congress. Our return guest this morning was the only recipient to make the files public. By contrast, the journalists at the New York Times and the Los Angeles Times returned the files to the FBI, as the FBI requested. And so did the members of Congress. This morning, we returned to our conversation to learn how exactly the world discovered the existence of COINTELPRO. The full story of the break-in and its impact on our society and government is told in our guest's 2014 book titled The Burglary, The Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI. Her telling of the story also inspired a documentary titled 1971. Betty Metzger is an investigative reporter, author, photographer, producer, media critic, and educator. Metzger was the head of the journalism program at San Francisco State University, where she also founded the Center for the Integration and Improvement of Journalism, which created model programs for how to recruit, retain, and place in journalism increasing numbers of ethnic minority people. She is the author of Framed, The New Right Attack on Chief Justice Rose Byrd and the Courts. Winds of Change, Challenges Confronting Journalism Education, and Women at Work, a photo documentary book. Betty Metzger, welcome back to What's Going On.
Thank you, Joanna. Thanks for inviting me back.
Well, we were riveted by the conversation we had last week about the burglary, which you title The Burglary in your book. Can you remind us about the purpose of the small group of people who organized what they called the Citizens Commission to investigate the FBI?
Yes, the Citizens Commission had a very specific goal, and that was to try to get documentary evidence of whether the FBI was trying to suppress dissent. They thought that they feared that that was happening, that there were a growing number of informers in both the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement, and they thought that if there could be documentary evidence presented to the public, that that would make a difference. And the first files that they released certainly showed that that was true. And what we discussed last week, for instance, the heart of those first files, the one that described in order to agents to cause paranoia, that was the word used, to try to make people think that there was an FBI behind every mailbox. And those early files that were released also showed incredible surveillance of the black community in general. I mean, sweeping programs that were aimed at getting as many files as possible on black people in the FBI office. And that meant not because of suspicion of crime or any record of violence or suspicion of violence in the future, simply trying to get as many black people in the files of the FBI as possible. And this raised a lot of anger at the time, calls for investigation of the FBI, investigations that did not move forward at that time. So we really, bad as those things were, including discovery of informers also on campuses, and every black student, for instance, at Swarthmore, being in the files of the FBI. Bad as those things were, the worst revelations were yet to come and took some time. Probably many of your listeners have heard of the worst of these operations, and they were called COINTELPRO, and some of them have become known. Interestingly, the most important file was not evident at the time that the original files were distributed, and it was a mere cover sheet on top of a file that was an article that said that college administrators were not being hard enough on professors and students who protested against the war. And that cover
Betty,
sheet.
Before we go there,
sure.
I wanted to ask you last week A little bit about the context within which these documents are discovered. Philadelphia was a hotbed of anti-war activity, probably more so than other cities across the country, which is a little counterintuitive, even for me as a historian. So these eight activists, citizens of conscience, decide that they're going to break into the office of the FBI, which they find miraculously right outside of Philadelphia. And they make this incredible discovery. It's a brave thing they do, which changes history. But why is Philadelphia, if you can just very briefly tell us why Philadelphia is so important to the story and why there's so much anti-war activity here?
Thank you. Yeah, that's an important question. Both the nature of the protests in Philadelphia and also the nature of that era are very important to understanding how in the world people would make a decision to break into an FBI office. Philadelphia had a vast group of people protesting the war. In any given week in the late 60s and the early 70s, there would be at least one significant anti-war rally in Philadelphia. And I think it happened because there was a special combination of people there who eventually joined together. First of all, you had a very large number of Quakers, pacifist Quakers in Philadelphia. And I think that was somewhat different from what you might find in other cities around the country. And then you also had religious organizations that were very much organized against the war, the Episcopal Peace Fellowship and the Catholic Peace Fellowship. Catholic Peace Fellowship, as a matter of fact, stood out because they became what they called more aggressive in their nonviolent opposition to the war, including breaking into draft board offices. You also had two large universities in the city and many small colleges in the city and right outside the city. And this, when they came together, they were quite a large force, and I think larger and more diverse, including involvement of working class people, especially in the Catholic peace movement. So, I mean, that I think describes why it was such a very large movement. And as John Raines, one of the eight people who broke into the office, would later say, it was such a large movement that we were actually able, that the people who broke in were actually able to think that we could do this and be, then if we succeeded, be absorbed into this very large movement. And that turned out to be true. I mean, the FBI thought of over 1,000 people that might have done this. And because there were so many people that were very active in the peace movement there.
And this was also the time of the reign of Frank Rizzo in Philadelphia, who was a mayor previously, the head of the police, who had risen up the ranks of the police department, and he was quite authoritarian, racist and repressive. This is the police chief and mayor who rounded up the Black Panthers and stripped them naked and had them rest against the wall. And these pictures were captured and reproduced across the country and the world. So this was really a fascinating combination of forces, some planned and others not, coming together to make this possible in the city of brotherly love. Can you tell us something about what these documents revealed And what we learned about the tactics and what they were doing, for example, with Martin Luther King, before we get into the question of how exactly it was that COINTELPRO was finally discovered.
Sure. And you're so right about Frank Rizzo. He was the police commissioner at this time. He would later become mayor. And I would also like to point out that the same divisions existed in Philadelphia within the newsrooms. When Frank Rizzo became mayor in the early 70s, he hired 20-some journalists from the various news organizations in the city to be part of his administration, sort of an unprecedented thing, I think, in any city for that to happen. So there were many journalists involved at the time helping to make Frank Rizzo the folk hero that he later became. And people in the civil rights movements and the anti-war movement were naturally reacting against this because the police department came down so hard on people. You would like to hear about COINTELPRO, I think, which is the most important thing that in the end that the break-in revealed. And we didn't realize it until we didn't realize the fullness of what it was. The burghers felt very gratified to find out the evidence that this suppression was taking place and it was now possible perhaps for people to do something about it. But they had no idea that there were also much worse things happening that were designed to destroy lives and even to kill people. I mean, in the end, when I look at everything that came out that we know, and we probably still don't know everything that COINTELPRO was doing, but it runs a range from crude to cruel to murderous. Just some quick examples of when I say crude, oranges that were injected with high-powered laxatives by the FBI and then given to campus leaders. Prostitutes known to have sexually transmitted diseases were hired and to infect activists. So it was a terrible range of things that one surveillance scholar termed that ranged from torture to espionage, a kind of tactics that a government might use on an enemy. And some of the examples, you mentioned Martin Luther King, and that is a prime example of the nature of the COINTELPRO operations. They tried to set up Martin Luther King to commit suicide. Hoover was enraged by the fact that he was given the Nobel Peace Prize. And so months before he was scheduled to go to Scandinavia to get the prize, the FBI set up a number of steps, including sending tapes to Martin Luther King and to Coretta King, his wife, designed to humiliate him and what the FBI hoped would lead him to commit suicide. This wasn't revealed. We didn't know about this until 1975 when the Senate was conducting investigations of the FBI and all intelligence agencies. But some of the other things that we learned was that the FBI, if some FBI agents would be coached and taught in how to give perjured testimony, make up testimony that would send some people, and I must say usually black people and most often Black Panthers, to prison falsely convicted for crimes that the FBI made up and agents testified to. And one of these that is an example of how damaging this was the case of Geronimo Pratt. He was a much decorated Vietnam veteran in Los Angeles and a leader in the Black Panthers in Los Angeles. And the FBI accused him and then prosecutors charged him with a murder that he did not commit. And he, Geronimo Pratt, claimed his innocence, tried to get a new day in court over 20-some years, 27 years to be precise. He was in prison for 27 years in California, 8 years of that in solitary confinement, all because of one of these COINTELPRO operations. Finally, after 27 years, he got his day in court, and the judge forced the FBI to provide evidence, submit evidence that it had suppressed at the time that showed what had actually happened. And he was exonerated for that crime. Just a terrible example. But then the worst example, and I imagine most of your listeners are very familiar with this, and that's the murder of Fred Hampton. And that was shown to us in a movie last year, Judas and the Black Messiah. Fred Hampton, again, a Black Panther leader, this time in Chicago, and an informer was hired to help the Chicago police plan how it would murder Fred Hampton. And they succeeded in doing that one evening in December 1969. And as typical in with such cases, after it happened, J. Edgar Hoover himself, who had approved the operation, and this is very important, these operations were generally approved by the director himself. In this instance, he wrote a letter to the informer congratulating him and giving him a cash bonus for his role in helping the Chicago police murder Fred Hampton. There are numerous such examples of these terrible operations.
Thank you for sharing that. We know the scaffolding of these operations, but this level of detail is just harrowing. The torture, the deliberate infection of organizers and activists, of citizens of this country, by an arm of the state is just beyond words in terms of its ethics. Can you talk to us about that term COINTELPRO and when and how it came to be revealed to Americans?
Sure. You're right about the ethics, but also I'd like to point out the legality. I mean, it was not legal for a law enforcement agency to be involved in these kinds of activities. And that because of that, I mean, this meant that the law enforcement mission, the key mission of the FBI, was actually destroyed by what Hoover was doing. It was not possible to prosecute cases because just about everything that they were doing in relation to these actions was illegal. But the story of, I mean, how COINTELPRO came to be known.
Wait, can you repeat that? It was not possible to prosecute?
It was not possible to prosecute. What I mean is that the FBI, because it increasingly was engaged in COINTELPRO and COINTELPRO-like activities, its law enforcement power and action felt
lawless.
It became lawless. It was really operating a vast lawless set of operations. You couldn't go into court with these kinds of cases because they were against the law. They should have been prosecuted themselves. That's what I meant by that.
Because they would essentially delegitimize the institution and lead to its disintegration if it were to go to court.
That's
is,
right.
Is that what you suggest? Yeah.
That's right. In other words, things shifted that instead of building cases that could be prosecuted in court. The FBI was, in fact, acting as a judge and jury itself, and choosing people whose political opinions Hoover strongly disliked, choosing people to literally damage. They wanted to expose and disrupt individuals and organizations. Neutralize was the word that was used. So this was done, you know, not by building cases against them that could be tried in court,
right,
but instead by secretly destroying them.
Oh, I see.
And I might also, I might also add that this also meant, because of the way they carried out these operations, despite a vast army of informers, they didn't learn about the things that they probably should have been learning about, like whether a bomb was going to go off at a Capitol, at the Capitol or any other place. And there were a lot of bombings during those days, but not one of them was ever discovered by the vast army of informers that the FBI had discovered in advance, for instance, so that it could be stopped, or even information discovered later to be able to prosecute anybody who would set bombs. So sort of illustrates how the law enforcement function of the FBI was severely damaged. But you asked about, yes, go ahead.
We need to do a station ID. Just reminding our listening audience that you're listening to the voice of investigative reporter and author Betty Metzger. In March 1971, she wrote the first stories about the files stolen by anti-war activists from an FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania, which provided the public with the first documentary evidence of the FBI's massive clandestine operations to suppress dissent by means of illegal surveillance and dirty tricks against civil rights and anti-war activists, and African-Americans in particular. You are listening to Non-Commercial Free Speech Radio, WBAI, at 99.5 FM in New York. And I'm Johanna Fernandez, your Friday host of What's Going On. And we're going to take calls a little later on, but we really want to get to the story of COINTELPRO very quickly. 212-209-2877. You should probably hold on and listen to the story. 212-209-2877 for your calls. Betty, tell us very quickly, how did COINTELPRO emerge? Or our discovery of it?
It emerged in late 1973 as a result of a lawsuit that was brought by NBC reporter Carl Stern. He had seen this cover sheet, and he became very curious about what that term at the top of it meant, COINTELPRO. He saw it as he was visiting the Senate Judiciary Committee office, and it was on someone's desk. And he saw it and started asking the FBI, what is this? And they refused to tell him. And he said, I'd like to see the files that explain the founding of it. What was it? What's the meaning of it? And they refused. And so he filed a lawsuit, and the FBI was ordered by a judge to give him the files that he requested that would explain what COINTELPRO was. Without Carl's curiosity, a year after the burglary, and then his determination to find out what COINTELPRO was, we may never have found out. It became extremely important. The public was aghast when we started to get information about what these programs actually were, and then Congress and also the Department of Justice started asking questions.
So some judge essentially demanded the files from the FBI, and the FBI turned them over?
He ordered a federal judge in Washington, ordered them to make the files available to Carl Stern. The FBI refused to do so and said it would appeal. And instead, an acting attorney general, Robert Bork, who became well known later for other reasons, but Robert Bork said, no, I won't appeal. And instead, he got the papers from the FBI and gave them to Carl. And at the same time, ordered the new attorney, a new attorney general at the time, to investigate the FBI. And the investigation didn't happen. Yet again, it was turned down, but then did start again in January of 1975, as a result of people learning about COINTELPRO, and also in December of 1974, a very important story about the CIA engaging in domestic spying, which was in a violation of its charter. That story in the New York Times by investigative reporter Cy Hirsch had a huge impact. And together, that information meant that Congress could no longer refuse to investigate the FBI.
So Congress was hesitant initially, and we have to really think about the context within which this is happening. This is at the very end of a movement that really began during World War II for the rights of Black Americans. The civil rights movement emerges during World War II. It goes underground in part because of the Red Scare. It resurfaces in the 1950s, and then it inspires the women's movement, the gay and lesbian liberation movement, the anti-war movement. The war is going on. The National Liberation Front in Vietnam is winning. There was the Tet Offensive that the Vietnamese lost, but they won politically around the world. This burgeoning anti-war movement domestically, American hegemony is being challenged on a mass scale. It loses the war. There are uprisings and rebellions across the country. So it seems that American society is falling apart at the seams, and everything is questioned. Government, for the first time, and its foreign policy is challenged. We can't really underestimate the power of this shift. It's a tectonic shift in consciousness in America that now we can question not just domestic policy, but U.S. foreign policy at the height of the Cold War. So without a movement on the ground, journalists don't have the confidence to pursue so doggedly a lawsuit against the FBI. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, it was everything that you said is important. It was a time, really beginning for journalists. I think that the first time that it started asking questions that of a part of the government that wasn't usually held accountable started in the mid 1950s with American journalists in Vietnam. Starting to question how the war was functioning, how we were carrying it out. Those questions had not been asked before. But then, sort of the most sacrosanct of organizations were the intelligence agencies, where it was the attitude was let them keep their secrets, and this was the beginning. The release of the FBI files, and then 3 months later, the release of the Pentagon Papers, which involved files from the military and the State Department, and also some intelligence files. This was the building of, or I should say, the breaking down of the culture of secrecy that surrounded intelligence agencies. And so it's for the first time you had journalists thinking about these agencies should be held to be accountable, the same as we try to do with other government agencies.
Betty, we have a caller or two. Let's take the caller. Caller, you're on the line. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Good morning, WBAI. Am I on the air?
You're on the air.
Good morning, Joanna. It's nice to hear your voice on the radio again. I just want, and good morning, Ms. Metzger, Betty Metzger.
Yay, tell us your name.
Michael from Newark, New Jersey.
Michael, welcome.
Thank you. What a pleasure to hear you and Betty on the radio. I wish you and WBAI long life and hope that Betty and you could formulate a on-air panel that would compare the left disruption with the ignorance or the support of white supremacist movements from that period, because it's very timely.
Wow.
It's important to look back, to look forward. And I'm really glad this program is very important, and you definitely are telling the people what's going on today, I tell you. I haven't read Betty's book, but I'm definitely going to. What's the title of it?
The Burglary. Tell us more, Betty.
The Burglary, the Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's FBI.
Okay.
And, Michael, we're going to invite Mike German to WBAI soon. He lives on the West Coast, so I'm going to have to do that interview off air. But Mike German is a former covert agent who left the FBI in 2004. He's the author of Disrupt, Discredit, and Divide, How the FBI Damages Democracy. And we hope to engage a conversation on what's going on today and what you mentioned about January 6th and the difference in treatment of these two sectors of society, the left in the 60s and the right wing today, is going to be the subject of our conversation in part. So thank you very much for making that observation. Betty, we don't have much time, about 3 minutes. Can you wrap it up for us?
Sure, I'll try. After all of my research about COINTELPRO, one of my conclusions is that among the many institutions and countless individuals who were severely hurt by this part of the FBI, I think that the most damage took place to black efforts throughout that half century of J. Edgar Hoover's reign as director, black efforts to claim basic rights. Just in countless ways, the FBI was trying to destroy those efforts, including at the highest levels where presidents were discouraged from supporting civil rights movement. And that was done very successfully by simply suggesting to them that, as he did, that this was part of a communist movement and you shouldn't have anything to do with it. I think without J. Edgar Hoover's efforts, I think that civil rights efforts would have moved forward in a much faster way. Also, there was such a strong effort against institutions, very large institutions, a 40-year campaign against the University of California, 40 years of sustained surveillance of professors at the Berkeley campus, and also the same thing with the Socialist Workers Party in New York, who took the FBI to court in the 70s and won and had a declaration that everything that had been done against them was unconstitutional, 40 years of attacking one organization. And I guess the last thing that I would like to say is, you know, it's always, how in the world was it possible for these things to take place? And there are a couple things that I conclude are most important. First, he could assume everlasting secrecy, a term used by the chief counsel to the church committee, the Senate committee that investigated. Fritz Schwartz said that. The fact that he could assume everlasting secrecy made him think that he could do absolutely anything. And then the other thing that was so important throughout J. Edgar Hoover's time, and it could be important at any time, and that is, excuse me, the failure to ask questions, the failure of Congress to ask questions, except for how much more money do you need, and our role in, as citizens in failure to ask questions was also so important. But the burglars decided questions had to be asked, and they ended up having this amazing impact.
And there's so many questions to ask about the world we live in today. And thank you, Michael, our caller, for asking that very important question. You've been listening to the voice of investigative reporter and author Betty Metzger. In March 1971, she wrote the first stories about the files stolen by anti-war activists from an FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania, which provided the pathway to the discovery of the counterintelligence program of the FBI. Betty, we hope that this is not the last conversation. We will definitely have a panel discussion, as was suggested, and we hope you will join us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Thank you, and have a wonderful day. I just want to say a few words about Tina Turner. Born into a sharecropping family as Anna Mae Bullock in 1939, she died Tina Turner in a palatial Swiss estate, the queen of rock and roll, a storm of a performer with a wildcat fierce voice, a dancer of visceral spine-tingling potency and ability, a beauty for the ages, a survivor of terrible abuse, an advocate for others in similar situations, an author, an actress, a devout Buddhist, a loving wife, a human being of rare talent and perseverance, who through her transcendent brilliance became a legend. That's Will Sternberg. You've been listening to WBAI, non-commercial, listener-funded free speech radio at 99.5 FM in New York. It's 7:57 and 57 degrees in Central Park this morning, Friday, May 26, 2023. The show is produced by Johanna Fernandez and Marcos Maldonado Cruz. Our executive producer is Linda Perry. Michael G. Haskins is our board operator. I'm your host, Johanna Fernandez. See you next Friday.
WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Coming up next.
The plant foods like fruits, vegetables, whole grains, and beans is good for your health. I use beans instead of meat.